Welcome to my dojo. This is Drunken Fist Happy Hour, a special edition of Kung Fu Pizza Party, where I take that 30 minutes or less stipulation and put it to the side, and instead, I grab a friend, grab a drink, and we just let the conversation meander like a good old-fashioned Drunken Fist Kung Fu practitioner. And this is also going to be part of the Going to the Arcade series I've been doing throughout this year as we look forward to Mortal Kombat 2, Street Fighter, getting films this year. We're picking up where we left off last month, getting back into the lore of Mortal Kombat. Joe Day is back with us for this. We both greatly underestimated how far we were going to get in 30 minutes or less. We weren't going to get through the whole thing. But we didn't even get through the tip of the iceberg. We got through the hype in the 90s and then era one of the Mortal Kombat franchise. We're going to pick things up from there. If you have not listened to that episode and you're like, why are you skipping all the originals? I love the original trilogy. It's not because we don't. We like the original trilogy. It's just that we already talked about it. So, like, just do your homework and go listen to that episode. Also, unless it is necessary, we're not going to go too deep into the movies here. We're focusing more on the video games. Joe's going to talk about Mortal Kombat Annihilation. He's contractually obligated. But we're going to save those for just their own movie review proper episodes. But with all that being said, Joe, welcome back to the dojo.
Thanks for having me, Beth. We got partway through that episode, and I realized very quickly that we were going to need to do this again, because there's a whole lot to talk about with Mortal Kombat, and it's funny, right? Because it's such a humble beginning that spawned all of this lore, and that's really where you see Era 2 really start to find itself in establishing more of the tell and not show side of lore, because like we talked about last time, all of it was done on text screens. Mm-hmm. And so now we're picking up in the era of 3D, where now we're starting to push the boundaries in a different direction. And again, Mortal Kombat finds itself right in the thick of pushing the envelope forward, both in the video game world and, like you said, contractually obligated, need to at least throw it out there in the cinematic world with MK Annihilation. So MK Annihilation basically is like the entry point into the shift, like away from Era 1, and is kind of that bridge point between Era 1 and Era 2. We started off doing a little bit in 3D, but by and large, the graphics, the stylings, all of that sort of stuff are so encapsulated in its time, for better and for worse, with all of its ludicrousness, that you see a lot of these concepts from the later movies pulled out and trying to capstone that story of 1, 2, and 3, because the first one is basically 1, and then the second one tries to be both 2 and 3, and it wins in places and it also loses in places. But as an apt a place to say it, a lot of these movies, man, for me, and I say the same thing about the video games, bad pizza is better than no pizza at all. You know what I mean? Like, true. Sometimes you just got to take it as a popcorn flick.
It's true. You know, given the option of no pizza or Little Caesars, you know what? I'll have a Little Caesars every once in a while. I'll have a Jack's frozen pizza every once in a while if it means I get some pizza. You know, you were talking about, like, almost like Mortal Kombat there in the 90s was kind of like the little engine that could of, like, kind of started a little bit underground arcade scene and then just exploded. And I know there's a lot of spin-off games, but sometimes I'm just so blown away by the fact there's 12 of the, like, mainline games, right? And that's not even counting, you know, Sub-Zero's origin game, the Mortal Kombat versus DC Universe, like it has grown so much. But even just counting like the mainline universe of 12 games, that's impressive from coming from just like a underground, violent, could have potentially gotten shut down by all the other people at the time who were like, these games are getting too violent. And yet here we are today, 2026, still going on. Had a little bit of technical difficulties there, folks. And when that happened, I cracked my beer and took a big swig of it, completely forgetting it's a sour beer. So I was like, oh, but as I was saying, I'll talk about what I'm drinking here in a second. As I was saying, Mortal Kombat kind of in the 90s was like the little engine that could of just this like underground game could have easily been knocked out by all of the rating and political things that were going on to kind of get this game shut down or cleaned up. And yet it has survived all this time. And now we're up to 12 mainline games, I think. Is there 12 in the main series plus additional spinoffs? Plus, obviously, we have the movies, there's comic books, animated features, the whole bit. And so I'm just genuinely impressed where Mortal Kombat has come all these years later.
Part of that is their willingness to redefine the formula and to be able to play in the sandbox that they set up for themselves. You know, whether it's the not backing down from blood and gore and all of that in the 90s, or trying something different and using whole cutscenes for MK Sub-Zero mythologies, where you have people actually dressed up as these characters that are having dialogue pieces around some of the first attempts at 3D rendering. And then that moves on to this era of MK, where they realized that, yes, there is a an opportunity to advance graphics, but it's not just about that. Now we can continue to build out this world in a way that gets people more invested, and that this is usually the path. Like, most people understand Liu Kang, they might understand Shang Tsung, you know, characters like that are more classic to the franchise: Raiden, Jack, Sonya Blade, Johnny Cage, the whole nine yards. But there are whole sections of the timeline that people don't realize are like a thing, like the fact that for a big chunk of the post original trilogy, Liu Kang is actually dead for multiple games. And there is a big bad that's even bigger than Shao Kahn, and even bigger than the Elder Gods and all of that sort of stuff. And that's where this is the part in the timeline where all of that starts to get fleshed out. And that starts with MK4, which was basically 3, but on steroids. It really tried to bring all of these characters to the forefront and was now in the era of being developed for at-home play primarily. You know, we're still in the arcade scene a bit, but previously it was arcade first and then adapted to home console. Okay. The arcade was still the prime mover. Now at this point, home consoles are the prime mover. And so now this entire development cycle is now around how do we get the most out of the at-home market, and that opens the door to expanding out the universe into the next layer from Shao Kahn, which is the Elder Gods. So previously, the Elder Gods had been basically faceless entities that were in the background. If you watched the movies, you were probably more aware of the Elder Gods than if you just played the games, because they were just mentioned in certain parts of the games. With four, now you have a fallen Elder God named Shinnok, who is the big bad alongside Quan Chi, which is basically our new secondary boss, a la Shang Tsung, you know. And so you see a lot of the same formula beats, but now we're escalating up to fighting against gods rather than warlords.
Gotcha. And you were saying that this is the MK4 is kind of the turning point away from arcade porting to home console, and now we're switching it up and we're going more home console focus first. And that makes sense too, because I just did a quick search. Like, this game came out in 97, and sadly we are starting to move out of the like mainstreamness of the arcade late 90s into the early 2000s. Thank God this is changing nowadays. I don't know what it's like in your area, but we are getting like a little bit of a resurgence, especially within the pinball world, it seems like, of just more of these. Because again, once being a millennial is nothing more than finally being an adult to have adult money to go spend on things that you wanted as a kid. So now we can all go play at our kids.
Basically.
Okay. So yeah, that's all I wanted to say. So yeah, it does make sense that this is also where we're starting to pivot into more of a home console first, arcade second kind of approach as well. Plus you have to keep up with the 3D rendering. We're at 64 at this point, right?
Yes. We're at 64 now. This one was first a Nintendo title and then PlayStation, I believe, but that's era that we're talking about. The PS, the original PlayStation, the N64. We're moving quickly toward disc-based gaming rather than cartridge-based. And it does show, but I think even going back to number four, you know, this is where you start to get some of Raiden's backstory, and you get another defender of Earthrealm in Fujin, and it's starting to draw in other mythologies and expand out the universe. And that's the funniest thing about this entire timeline, it's built from the standpoint of we were successful first and then started building mythology around it. Because when you're talking about a wall of text on a screen, there's only so much character work that you can do with that. Same thing with the manuals, right? So for those of you that are listening that are not of a particular vintage, every single video game would come with a little pamphlet that had tips in it, that had character bios in it, that maybe had a map in it, depending on the game. And, you know, you would read that thing like it was like an extension of playing the game. And so Mortal Kombat, using every inch of real estate that they could muster, did a lot of their character bios there in addition to just on the screen. And so here you're getting some of the points that would go on to define the franchise as a whole. Scorpion and Sub-Zero being lifelong enemies. The actual truth behind what happened to Scorpion's family. The backstory between Shinnok and Raiden and the relationship with the Elder Gods and all of that jazz, where now it goes beyond just the tournament. And that's one of the big things that, like, you'll see in the modern day is people talk about how many tournaments are there actually in Mortal Kombat? The answer is not very many of them. Eventually, it becomes more like an interdimensional conquest story rather than specifically a tournament-based story. But that's to its benefit because now you're starting to get more of the realms beyond just Earthrealm and other world as part of the landscape.
Gotcha. And it all sounds a little bit Lovecraftian with these giant elder gods who are faceless. But we're going to start fleshing them out more, is my understanding.
Yeah. So there are definitely... the hints of that sort of cosmic Lovecraftian horror to the story that also lives with like power dynamics and warlords and like survival of the fittest and all of that sort of stuff. But there is absolutely a dichotomy here with the gods structure of Mortal Kombat, because on one hand you have Raiden and Fujin, you have very personable gods that are meant to walk alongside people, but they are considered lesser than these gods that are overseeing everything, that are very much presented as larger than life. They are not like a Greek god or any of these deity structures where Norse mythology is big now because of the MCU, where these characters are humanoid in respect to other humanoids. These are not. The depictions that you're getting are basically big floating heads, or just a manifestation of whatever their element is that they represent.
It's the giant floating hand at the end of Super Smash Bros. Melee. Like, this is what you're dealing with here. It's just a giant body part. So we enter the new era kind of by way of Mortal Kombat Annihilation, Mortal Kombat 4 proper. So what is our story arc here with 4 and the next subsequent games that it is connected to?
So basically, with Shao Kahn defeated, the next major threat is basically from the Shadows of Myth. It's presented as this boogeyman of sorts some people think isn't real, some people think could never come back, but is treated with gravity that even Shao Kahn wasn't treated with when they present Shinnok. And the whole idea is that he's a fallen elder god that was banished from Netherrealm, and he escapes his imprisonment and launches the next invasion story of the realms. So we're not fully abandoning the format yet. It's just that instead of it being Shao Kahn against Earthrealm, it is Shinnok against all the realms. And then it still comes down to the, Earth's Mightiest Heroes banding together and stopping the threat. But you're seeing more involvement from Raiden now at this point. That's the big shift. Because all of the foes are now ratcheted up. Now we need more involvement from Raiden. Wants to fight alongside the humans, and because he does that, Fujin ends up stepping in as Earth's guardian god, essentially, you know, filling that role of that Raiden had. And then you start to, in the midst of all of this, get little nuggets that would start to flesh out as the other realms started getting fleshed out. But okay. This is the first time that you get the mention of Adenia, which is another realm that would go on to be very important as the story would start to flesh out.
Gotcha. It's interesting. And it worked. It worked. Don't get me wrong. But it's so interesting to just kind of start with the tournament. Okay, let's redo number one again, just escalate. Okay, now we're going to do number three, which is going to be number two, just rev it up by 1,000. And now we're going to start fleshing things out. And it worked. Good for them. Glad it did. But it's just so interesting that you can go so long. I mean, Joe and I, along with this era or this kind of media, we also like things like Narnia and Lord of the Rings and like Star Wars and Star Trek. A lot of these things that, like, sure, they get expanded upon in the years to come, but they all kind of started with more of like a base, I would say more of a base understanding of this is what the world is. This is what the mythology is that then expanded out from there. Prequels and requels and all of that do play a factor, obviously, but it's just really interesting that it just it goes from so like literally one dimensional to this like more 3D, like in living color kind of story that just somehow still manages to find ways to rev it up. We're just going to keep escalating and it's going to work, because if you are starting, that is one thing for sure, is that if you are starting at ground zero with, if they win this tournament again, everything's doomed, then you really have no place else to go but up. You can't, like, turn it back down from there.
Yeah. And that's where I think you see one of the biggest shifts from the longevity of Mortal Kombat to basically the longevity of any of its contemporaries. So the rest of these series are either predicated around some kind of military conflict or some conflict with an individual or a tournament of the greatest or whatever the case may be. They each have their own stories, but from a scale standpoint, we're not talking about end of the world stuff, by and large.
Yeah.
Not saying that's a universal fact, but we're talking about the class of creations that produced Mortal Kombat and the rest of its contemporaries. So we're not talking modern or anything else like that. The fact that they incorporated basically a shotgun approach to storytelling is exactly the thing that saved it. Because we're going to see with the next entry, they flip everything. They level the playing field, because we're about to jump to the PS2. And again, for those of you that don't know, depending on what your vintage is, because even though it hurts my soul, the PS2 is considered a legacy system now at this point, like retro gaming and all of that. For frame of reference for everyone, the PS2 was the undisputed king when I first got into retro gaming, when it was first, when the term retro gaming was first really minted and all of that. So there's that. The fact that they threw so much forward and then started from bleakest hour to fighting up without really explaining much of anything, I think is exactly why they were able to add so much on after the fact, why they were able to explore out the world as things progressed, as technology progressed, as the medium for storytelling progressed, and as that really did become normalized, because as we're getting from N64 to PlayStation to PS2 and beyond, the expectation of deeper story and mythology is very present in gaming. Like, gamers are now expecting more out of their games. And so this idea of let's go back to the formula, but let's do so while adding more to the mythology, I think is basically the formula that MK carried forward basically until the end of the 3D era. You could argue that, like, towards the end, like the last game or two, were the ones that really threw out this idea of it being precipitated on any kind of rule or structure or anything else like that. Like, by the time we're out of the 3D era, we're talking about Armageddon, we're talking about end of the world type stuff, we're talking about the collapse of all of the realms and all of that sort of stuff. Like, the scale is back. That's why MK9, when they did the branching timeline thing, was so significant, because really, basically through this entire thing, it's the ramifications of the failed invasion, the power grab that happens after Shinnok, and all of the different characters and moving pieces that really defines that entire section. And so the tournament thing is out the window, and they really don't go back to that on screen until 9, when they wind the clock back. But here at the story, at this point in the story, we have, you know, Shinnok comes forward, has his second in command, Quan Chi, just as conniving as Shang Tsung, so also in it for himself, another sorcerer and all of that, basically king of the hell dimension, essentially. And you come to find out, he is the reason why Scorpion became a remnant, and he is the one that actually killed Scorpion's entire clan and blamed it on Sub-Zero. And so that way he could control Scorpion and point him towards vengeance against the good guys and all of that, because Scorpion was a good guy. And that basically all comes to light in 4, that he's really the one that orchestrated all of this. And that's where you start to get Scorpion pushing more towards anti-hero and less of an out and out villain.
Gotcha. PlayStation 2 may be the coolest console I never owned. I never had a PlayStation 2. Friend had a PlayStation 2. Yeah. So I remember playing whatever was the Crash Bandicoot game that was made for that one. I can't think of its name now. I could visualize it because there was a whole like medieval section. But I never owned that one. GameCube, had the GameCube, which I think was the Nintendo contender right around that time as well. So how many games do we have here in the 3D era? Starts with 4, moves through.
So there's 4 of them. There's 4, Deadly Alliance, Deception, and Armageddon. So 4 is the one with Shinnok. We wrap up. There's a giant giant power vacuum by the end of the game. 5 decides to do something wildly different with the new technology. It's also a bit of a jump as far as time goes. This would be one of the largest periods of time without a Mortal Kombat game. We don't pick back up until 2002. So now in 2002, the PS2 is all the thing, and so now we've got full-scale cutscenes that are meant to be like mini-movies and things like that. And so you've got this cold open where, with Shinnok defeated, Shang Tsung and Quan Chi decide to team up against everybody, and they're known as the Deadly Alliance. And they essentially do the thing that villains very rarely decide to do. Don't fight fairly and just surprise somebody and keep attacking together until you kill the guy that you're trying to kill. You know what I mean? Like, it's presented with a measure of ruthlessness that doesn't give time for quipping or for sitting there monologuing while your opponent gets their strength back and all of that sort of stuff. So
if I may interrupt, the ever classic fight scene in a movie where the bad guys come one at a time, the thugs come one at a time, and everyone waits patiently. We're not doing that here. Also, I'll say this before you get too far into the next one. Brilliant. No notes there, Mortal Kombat number 4. You left it on a cliffhanger. There's a power vacuum. You wrote it that time. Rather than, okay, we'll just do the other one and rev it up, we actually like have a bit of an in for the next one. Well done. Continue.
Yep. Finally decided to lean into it and say, okay, we're going to start telling more stories and things like that. And so Liu Kang training sequence at the Shaolin Temple is confronted by both Shang Tsung and Quan Chi at the same time. Our hero is defending himself well enough, and you think that this is going to be yet another story of LOL John Cena, just because that's Liu Kang at first. Liu Kang is John Cena at first.
Okay. That's awesome.
And then they do the unthinkable, that in an opening sequence, before the events of the game even kick off, Liu Kang is killed in the opening sequence of the game. People went bug nuts about this because you killed the franchise protagonist. There really wasn't like now. We can say, oh, I finally want my story about Johnny Cage, right? Like, that's the big thing about this new movie that's coming out. I want my Johnny Cage centric MK story and all of that. Mm-hmm.
Yes, that is what I want. Thank you.
Yeah. There are others now that they have been forced to have shared the spotlight. Nobody was there at this point. Arguably, the only other person that would have been in that space was Raiden. And so this was truly a step forward into uncharted territory. And so they form the pack. They combine their efforts and they take down Liu Kang. And then basically from this point, their whole goal is to resurrect Onaga, the Dragon King. Basically what they want to do is they want to create this army where they're basically an army of dead, of the dead. That's the best way of saying it. They're technically soldiers. They're not actually dead, but basically whoever controls Onaga controls this vast army. But this is one of those stories that ends very much as an Empire Strikes Back sort of story. So like Raiden retreats, goes to gather the forces, but by the end of this story, they don't actually win. the you've got Kung Lao, who's a descendant of the first champion that was also named Kung Lao. He dies. Then you have other characters like the Earth Special Forces, which is essentially like their military. They die. The game ends with Raiden beaten by the villains. And so this was very much meant to be like a dark and gritty entry toward like this isn't the same sort of IP as its contemporaries, because here sometimes the villains win.
And I would say, you know, you brought up the granddaddy of them all there with Empire Strikes Back. I think at some point, either because of longevity or just for good old good storytelling, you need this entry. You need the, and then the bad guys win, you know? It makes it, okay, yes, video games are fun, escapism, blah, blah, blah. It does add a level of realism of like, okay, yeah, yep. Sometimes the powers of evil, the forces of evil, the darkness of this world does get an upper hand. Like, we see that in the real world, sadly. And I totally understand that you'd rather not see it in your video game. At least you get to punch it in this one. You get to punch it. You use other cool superpowers, which is nice. A little bit of processing that you could do with that. But I think also just from a good storytelling standpoint, you need this entry. You need a comeback. You need a comeback story somehow. And either you can start with the comeback story. You could almost say that's how the Fellowship of the Ring ends, with the whole group being disbanded. You know, the whole thing like kind of seems to be falling apart there at the end of that first movie. Or Empire Strikes Back, Infinity War, any of those where it's like we're several stories in now. Okay, it's time for Luke to lose his hand now. It's time for half of the universe to be snapped out of existence.
Yep. Yeah. And so you've got, and in the midst of the storytelling, I thought they did some pretty cool work trying to establish new characters. So Liu Kang's dead, and basically you've got the replacement Kung Lao. Like I said, there was the Earth's first major champion, Kung Lao, is the protector, is like this protector of Earthrealm, and he wins these tournaments and he keeps evil at bay, and then he's killed by Goro. And basically from the part of Goro killing the original Kung Lao is where we get the dominance of Outworld until the events of the first one, and so on and so forth. And now with Liu Kang dead, they basically bring Kung Lao, also named Kung Lao, his ancestor. And so we also get a blind swordsman named Kenji, who is a really cool character throughout the entirety of the post 3D era. But you all, and you're getting kind of a bleak timeline of, there is conflict in Outworld at that Kitana, who is what is now ruler of Outworld. She's leading a charge there. And then you've got the Special Forces crew. They're stopped. Then you've got the Raiden. He's defeated. So everything seems bleak and dark. And it's positioned in a way going into Deception that the Deadly Alliance could only really be defeated by their own ego. And so they start fighting against each other in the opening sequence of Deception, like you see Raiden get defeated, and then you see the Deadly Alliance starting to fight against each other, and then you get the introduction of Onaga, the Dragon King, the ruler of Outworld before Shao Kahn. And so he's presented as, again, an even bigger escalation of that big bad formula. But now, instead of just doing the same thing over again, this is where we get an entire preponderance of backstory. We learn that Onaga's revival was secretly orchestrated for years through a warrior named Shujinko, that is the protagonist of Deception's story.
I pulled it up here on my phone, the order of the game, so I can kind of keep up with you, since we're also moving away from numerics. You know, we have Deception, Armageddon. I want to make sure I keep this all straight. But I had Mortal Kombat 4 still up on my phone. You know what that was also on? Sega Dreamcast. You may quote me on this. 100% underrated system. I love the Sega Dreamcast. You cannot take that one away from me. Love the Dreamcast.
I had a Dreamcast. I love Dreamcast. I think it was just ahead of its time. I think it just came out at the wrong time. Like, it was coming out against, like, the PlayStation is the one that salted the earth. It torched everything to the ground and redefined what console gaming was. And if it weren't for the PlayStation and it coming again, and Sega being a piss poorly run company, that would have been a much bigger deal.
I played the shit out of Crazy Taxi on that console, man. That was good. And I had the pod racing, the Star Wars pod racing game. I had that one on Dreamcast as well. That was a lot of fun. So we are on Armageddon. Is that where we're up to? MK Armageddon?
No. So we are still in Deception.
We're still on Deception. Okay. Turn in your Bibles to Mortal Kombat Deception. Yeah. That's kind of how I feel exactly. At this point, to make sure I keep up. There we go. Okay. I'm with you now.
Yep. Okay. So Onaga hits the scene, and we find out that there's this mode in the game called Conquest Mode, and you are playing as Shujinko, and you are basically going through and you are learning the game mechanics by learning everybody's fighting style, because you're running into all of the main characters throughout the different stages of this thing. But you're also collecting mystical items, and the idea is you're on this holy mission from the Elder Gods, and that you think you're doing the right thing by collecting these mystical artifacts that collectively are known as the Kamidogu. It is essentially a dagger. The Kamidogu dagger is the thing that is imprisoning the elder one. I'm blanking on the name, because he's not actually a part of the story, he's always just referenced, but he's basically like all of the realms were one realm, and the elder gods basically killed him and separated the realms into the different realms that inhabit the Mortal Kombat world, and each one has a piece of the Kamidogu. And the idea here is that you don't want to put it all together, or else he's going to come back. And so our Shujinko is basically tricked into collecting them. But in all actuality, he's being duped by Onaga to go through and collect all of them so that way Onaga can return, and which he does. And when he enters, it's meant to be like earth shaking. He's presented as towering and armored and basically impervious to any of the attacks. He literally swats away the Deadly Alliance and as well as Raiden. And so you basically have this darkest moment before Shujinku finally, you know, an aging warrior challenges Onaga, and because you went through and used his unique ability to absorb the fighting abilities of everybody else as you were basically learning the game mechanics and all of that, they fight, he wins, and he shatters the Kamidogu dagger, which strips Onaga of his magical invincibility, and thus they defeat Onaga and move forward to basically a new prophecy and the end game for this point in the story.
Mortal Kombat has something for everybody, doesn't it? It's so much more than just a beat 'em up. You know, we got superpowered warriors, we've got end of the world, literally Armageddon shaking events, sci-fi, alien monster creatures, and silly magic spears. Like, we've got a little bit of like everything, sword and sorcery, horror, martial arts. It is really a little bit of everything for everyone, and I love it for that.
Yep. So everything, you know, has to come to a boiling point here, partially because behind the scenes, we are starting to see that popularity is starting to wane a little bit in this franchise. And so we are now at a point where we have this end of the world, you know, this prophecy that everybody, heroes and villains alike, are going to have to fight to save the all of the realms from this creature named Blaze, essentially an elemental that is threatening the existence of the entirety of the realms. And so when again doing the going the route of these big set pieces that are driving the look and feel of these games, you've got this giant tower sequence where, or giant pyramid sequence where everybody's fighting everybody, and the whole idea is that whoever beats Blaze is the one that gets the power. And so
return to form here, then. We're back to tournament.
Essentially.
Okay.
Well, less tournament here, okay. More of a free-for-all. It's basically like one giant action set piece where everybody and anybody is going after each other to try and win the ability to basically control the realms. And what's interesting about this at this point is Raiden, you're already seeing as the fallible leader in all of this, because so much of the story sits in the 3D realm, where the next era after that, you basically get a reboot, and it kind of circles back around and all of that. But Raiden gets his hands on Shinnok's amulet. So Shinnok has his whole source of his power is his amulet. Now, the problem with having the amulet is that it will influence you towards evil. And this is the first time of multiple times that we get Dark Raiden, where basically Raiden is sick of everybody's shit. And he's just going to start unaliving people. Like, just you step out of line, okay, you're dead. Like, it's basically Raiden in the Punisher form. And so, and he gets a whole new costume in the whole nine yards. And so
I forgot I was on mute, but when you brought up Dark Raiden, I went, okay, continue. That you had to hear the because it's Dark Raiden.
Yeah. And so so now, you know, we come to find out that Shujinko is part of a royal lineage of Adenia that is essentially looking to preserve the integrity of the timeline. And so they basically create an elemental called Blaze, and basically the idea is that whoever wins, well, the idea was that one of their sons, Taven or Dagon, would win the tournament. And so you basically go from all of this, like the tournament and then the bad guy and then all of that sort of stuff, to a royal family debate that centers around the finality of this universe.
By the way, so this is Armageddon, just to be clear. Yes. So Armageddon, this is wild to think about. This one was on PlayStation 2. We're still PlayStation 2. It's on the original Xbox and the Wii. This was on the Wii.
Oh, wow.
A year later.
It was out that time.
It probably would have been, when you go back, so in the previous installment, Deception, 2005 GameCube. So that means this is like the end of that gen of consoles, and the Wii is somehow the cutting edge one having the Mortal Kombat game. I love the Wii. I had a Wii, played it for days. It was just a little bit silly with certain games, and fighting games was kind of one of those where, like, it if it was something super simple, like a Wii boxing, for example, on the Wii Sports Pack, like, okay, that's fine. But anything, basically, if it was rated M, it just didn't make sense to play on the Wii. Call of Duty Black Ops was weird on the Wii. I had the, you know, SmackDown versus Raw and all of those on the Wii at the time. It was kind of fun because, you know, you could do like the suck it and all that. But yeah, just let that one sink in for you for a moment. One of the biggest, most bombastic installments in the MK franchise. Yeah, that was on the Wii. On the Wii.
So we have this whole side story that Taven was going to be the one that takes the power of Blaze because they're trying to ensure that their bloodline will be able to basically have the power to direct the realms and existence and all of that jazz, even though we are going to come to find out that there is a much bigger power hierarchy above where we're at right now, but we'll get there. So this whole thing is like the X-Men Days of Future Past timeline. So like this is like Darkest Timeline, and this whole sequence where you see different people get taken out by different people, and you see other people who have been killed along the way. You even get a return of zombie Liu Kang, which is a thing that he's been showing up randomly in the basically post his death, where he becomes a playable character where like even his neck is off to the side because that's how he dies, is his neck is snapped, and wonderful. So like his neck is off to the side in the whole nine yards. And so you basically have the culmination of everything that's happening, and the person to finally defeat Blaze is Shao Kahn. And so Shao Kahn is back in the driver's seat, and so now this game ends with Raiden defeated by Shao Kahn, and he's holding his amulet, and says he must win, and everything goes up in a blinding white light, and that's the end of the game, and you don't pick back up until MK9, which is basically the Scream 2022 of the franchise, where basically we're recalling the original and calling it the same name as the original. So it's Mortal Kombat 2009.
There is a very important installment before that. Shout out to Mortal Kombat versus the DC Universe. That's where that one takes place, is right in between these two. The universe is maybe destroyed, or maybe they just slipped into the multiverse and hung out with the DC characters for a bit and then came. Love that game. I have a fond high school memory. Sorry. Joe and I are actually close in age, but when we talk about the old days, the timeline doesn't match up. So when I was in high school is when Mortal Kombat versus the DC Universe was out. And I have a very fond memory of my one buddy in high school for his birthday every year. He would host an all-nighter at his house. And usually, given the era, my friends were super into Call of Duty, World at War, Halo, Borderlands, those kind of games. I sucked at first-person shooters. But one year, he had just gotten MK versus DC, and we played that all night. It was just kind of that good old, like, okay, you lost, past the controller kind of thing. And I held the controller the most that evening. I can't do first person shooters, but you give me just a simple flat screen to move back and forth on. Okay, yeah, I can do that.
Yeah, it's. I'm very similar in that way, where I am not the best at FSPs, but beat 'em ups I am very good at. And that game is awesome. There are several in this, and so that one, Shaolin Monks is another one that's basically like a reboot of MK2, and it is a complete departure, but it is a phenomenal game. It's nice. Made in like this little, it's basically like a pocket what if game that doesn't actually affect the timeline, but it is a phenomenal game. So with Mortal Kombat, with MK9, the franchise literally hits a reset, and this is where we're in what's called the reboot era. So 9 and 10 are essentially remakes of 1 and 2. And the sequence that happens at the very beginning of 9 is the continuation of Armageddon. So you see all of the events of Armageddon play out, and then that blinding white light then cuts to a much younger Raiden who's working with the characters from the first tournament. And so basically what we're doing is we're speedrunning through remaking the originals. And we're establishing all of these people, but at little points along the way, we get diversions on the path. So, like, for instance, the introduction of the Cyber Initiative, where the ninjas are getting cyberized, which has been a thing in the lore, but now we're bringing it fully into the games, where Smoke gets turned into a cyberized ninja, and so does Sub-Zero. And you get this mystery of, what does it mean he must win? Now, the original assumption is that means Liu Kang. But Liu Kang, basically, in a fit of rage, so Kung Lao is killed by Shao Kahn. Liu Kang gets pissed, and like halfway through the MK9, puts his fist through Shao Kahn. And basically does away with basically capstones that tournament part of the arc, and that doesn't change anything. And so then you get all of this side stuff with Quan Chi that is bringing in the elements of Four, where he's working alongside Shinnok and all of that sort of jazz. And you see basically all hell break loose, where a bunch of people die, a bunch of things go wrong, and it come to find out that the person who has to win is Shao Kahn, because then the Elder Gods would step in and basically correct the idea of Shao Kahn ending up with ultimate power. And that
interesting,
like, that whole like capstone is essentially where you are getting like this like branching timeline that could go off on its own thing and stay its own thing and be separate from the main timeline, but then you get 10, and 10 is arguably one of the most divisive games in the franchise. I would say that 11 is probably still, well, Mortal Kombat 1, seriously, not kidding, is probably the more divisive of the two. But essentially, 9 goes into 10. And 10, you come to find out that there is basically an Elder God of time. You learn,
okay.
You meet Shinnok's mother. And she controls the hourglass, the cosmic hourglass of time, and you come to find out that she is essentially orchestrating the timeline in a way where her family wins. And so she is like the ultimate big bad, and she is the reason why Liu Kang and Raiden end up fighting each other so in all of these different timelines, because in the midst of all of this, in the midst of the goings on of 9, Raiden kills Liu Kang because they get into an argument, because it looks like Raiden's lost his mind and nobody ends up trusting him, and so they fight and he kills him, and basically Liu Kang gets turned into a revenant with everybody else that's died along the way at the hands of Quan Chi, and becomes the new, he and Katana, both revenants, both dead by this point, become the rulers of Netherrealm as basically like the undead versions of their main counterpart. And so again, you have Raiden has screwed up. He killed the main guy. Shao Kahn has to win in the end, and it's the Elder Gods that step in and basically reset everything. And that's why in 10, it's essentially the Johnny Cage story. Johnny Cage and his bloodline are the ones that are basically the new main story beat for the franchise in the absence of Liu Kang, but we eventually get to what ends up happening with Liu Kang and him taking back over as king.
So I'm trying even to collect my thoughts there. Sorry, you're not supposed to just like pause randomly in an audio recording. My bad. So as we talked about earlier, part of this whole thing is that they started at 10 and revved it up from there. So I get multiple timelines. I get time travel. I get all of that. Have we maybe lost the plot a little bit here? Have we, maybe to use a different metaphor, have we jumped the shark by the time we get to Mortal Kombat 9 and 10? Have we maybe jumped the shark a little bit here in an attempt to, I think what would make sense, to reboot, kind of start fresh? Have we done it in like the most complicated way possible?
So where we jumped the shark. So in order to answer your question, I need to go into another area where MK was pushing the envelope when it came to console gaming. And again, okay, really the ones that were ahead of the curve in a big way, and then kind of explain, because we're not, the answer is yes, but we're not quite there yet. And there's actually an opportunity for them to pick back up in a meaningful way, but they don't necessarily do that. So one of the big things that MK9 introduced to the formula was DLC. Playable characters from other franchises or other IPs that you bought the skin for. And oftentimes they had a fighting style that was akin to somebody else that was already on the roster, and it was just kind of copy and paste. Not a formula unknown to the Mortal Kombat timeline and legacy, because we're talking about a franchise that started with palette swap ninjas. Like, everybody's the same exact fighting style. They just got palette swaps of colors, and sure, so which would become, you know, Scorpion and Sub-Zero and all of the different ninjas and all that. So definitely familiar territory, but that's kind of a big part of what drove the ship for MK and for NetherRealm Studios. Yes, there was a story happening, and you ask Ed Boon in any of his interviews, he will talk about how he had this, you know, this grand story in mind and all of that, but it was a cash cow, because you started putting skins of different characters, and it became the extra moneymaker for each one of these titles, and that at some point became the more dominant moneymaker than actually telling the compelling story. And so that, coupled with the fact that at this point, so with 9 and to an extent 10, they, as a package, I'll put them together as a package deal, they were kind of like a love letter to the originals, where we're basically speedrunning through that original set and remaking them with new technology in a way that connects with the larger universe. And along the way, when we introduced the idea of multiple timelines, was where things started going haywire. And essentially, there's this moment where Raiden and Liu Kang realize that they've been in this same situation. And when Kronika, the mother of Shinnok, when Kronika unveils that they've been here before, and they realize that they're falling directly into her hands, there's interesting character work done. Now, some people hate Raiden, other people love Raiden because he's messy and he's complicated and all that sort of stuff, but he's not really good at his job. Like, the thing is that Fujin is always the better protector of Earthrealm than Raiden is. And because Raiden is emotional, Raiden is short-sighted, and he's very human in that regard.
I'm looking at the DLCs. I pulled up the DLCs while you were talking about all of that. MK9, not too bad. You get like Kratos from Gods of War and Sweet Tooth from Twisted Metal. At least those make sense. MK10, Jason Voorhees, Predator, Xenomorph, Leatherface. Yeah, we really are just going for a cash grab at this point. Don't get me wrong, sure, we just did gush a little bit about a whole separate spin-off game where they're fighting DC characters. At least that's its own thing, whereas this is like, okay, sure, it would be cool to watch Sub-Zero fight a Xenomorph, but like, why? Yeah. Why are we doing this? Why Leatherface and Jason Voorhees? Like,
so fun fact, there is a version of MK9 that you will never be able to play again because one of the DLCs was Freddy Krueger, because the remake had just come out. And so he was a playable character. Now, the problem with the Wes Craven estate and the rights to Nightmare is that really nobody really knows. Like, those of us in the horror fandom are just like sitting here in limbo because nobody actually knows where the rights are held or any of the particulars after Wes passed away. And so because he wasn't the director for all of them, it's all very complicated. And so because of rights, that version with him as the deal as a playable character, you'll never be able to play that again because it's set in it sits currently in rights hell.
Interesting. That happens a lot in the horror world for some reason. Things get a little screwy with copyrights in the horror world, whether it's that or I know I'm a little bit more familiar with all of the stuff that the Friday the 13th franchise has had to go through with who owns that. Still to this day, people aren't really sure who owns all the Lovecraft stuff, if it's the estate, his friend, if it's all just public domain by this point. Then, of course, there's the whole Night of the Living Dead situation. Like, it's just copyrights get weird with horror movies. And not to get ahead of you, but I just pulled up 11, Mortal Kombat 11, and the DLCs get even weirder. It gets even weirder with 11.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, by that point, you're now affected by basically the entirety of Call of Duty and all of their skins and reskins and all of that sort of jazz. So you get to this point where you find out that Kronika is basically situating this entire thing to make sure that her family is the one that's in power, and you end up in a finale where Shinnok comes back at the end of 10, and he launches a full scale attack, corrupts the Jensei chamber, which is basically the Well of Souls for the universe, and looks like it's, you know, again, darkest timeline sort of thing, with, you know, Shao Kahn is out of the way, Shinnok takes back over, Kronika is, you know, pulling the strings in the background. Johnny Cage gets his flowers by being the one that takes out Shinnok. But in the process of all of it, they get Shinnok's amulet back. Raiden gets it. We've got Dark Raiden 2.0, and basically as punishment to make sure that Shinnok never does what he did again, Raiden cuts off his head, breaks his jaw off, and basically keeps the head as a trophy.
As he should. Yeah, that's what you do with those.
Yeah. So there's this scene with Dark Raiden, where Dark Raiden basically throws down the head of Shinnok at the feet of undead Liu Kang and Kitana, and basically says, "If you keep screwing around, basically F around and find out." You know what I mean? Like, we're not playing anymore.
Totally.
We're gonna burn everything to the ground, sort of thing. And gotcha. So now 11 fully Kronika is the one that is that is driving everything, and in the midst of all of it, you get the timeline clash between the older versions of these characters mixed with the new versions of these characters, and now we full blown have the entire the entire toy box dumped out on the floor.
we somehow have gotten back to the 90s of just dumping all the action figures out. It's a timeless childhood thing, though, because my living room floor is totally covered right now in Spider-Man, Paw Patrol, and wrestling figures, and just everything. That is how you play. You dump it all out, and it's all a multiverse of madness. Unless it involves really weird DLCs. I still can't get over some of these DLCs. Yeah. 11 has Rambo in it. And the Terminator.
Yep. So we basically have the showdown with Kronika and the heroes. And it basically comes down to younger Raiden and Liu Kang basically becoming one entity, and we get Fire God Liu Kang, a fusion of the God of Thunder and the God of Fire, and the final like showdown it for the main game is Liu Kang versus Kronika, in which canonically Liu Kang wins. And we'll get to canonically here in a second.
Okay. Okay.
So
go ahead. I have no quips. Go ahead.
The capstone for that is an extra add-on called MK11 Aftermath. So,
okay.
Fire God Liu Kang beats Kronika, basically is ready to start using the hourglass, doesn't have her crown, which is the source of her power, and which means he'll basically destroy reality if he tries to do it without the crown. Enter Shang Tsung. Now, for this entire thing, you haven't seen Shang Tsung, Nightwolf, or Fujin. All three of them show up saying that they were all basically too powerful of threats for Kronika to keep on the field, so they've been locked away for this entire time. And okay. So the idea here is that you've got to trust Shang Tsung, send him back to the past to retrieve the crown and bring it back. And that's so there's this like side quest where you're playing as Shang Tsung and you're going back through the events of the game from a different POV. And then all of that results in, shocker of shockers, Shang Tsung double crosses everybody, and you think that, oh, he's got, you know, the one up on everybody, and now he's gonna be back to being the big bad, and then we're in the next game, we're gonna have to. Nope. The end, Fire God Liu Kang knew the entire time that he was going to, had all of this set up for basically get the crown and Shang Tsung all in the same place, all of that. And the last game, or the last fight of the game, is a fight between Liu Kang and Shang Tsung, and you get to choose who you play as. Canonically, ooh, Liu Kang wins. Canonically, okay, he's the one that walks away with the power. But okay, if you were so inclined, you could play as Shang Tsung, and Shang Tsung could win out today.
Oh, okay. So, got some multiple endings, something that the game was kind of known for there at one point in time. And we're kind of getting all the way back to the beginning here again with the fact that Liu Kang wins. Lol. Like this, We really have, it was a quite the shark that we had to jump over, but we really have gotten back to 9 and 10 kind of being like the speed run of the originals.
Yeah, yeah. And so 9, 10, and to an extent 11 has some of the tones, but 11 is really where it starts to break back into its own story, like a different just not remaking sort of deal. But up to this point, like you're homaging, and that's where I say like there it was this love letter to the originals, and but in the midst of it with the time travel thing, they met the shark, but they had the opportunity to get past the shark with MK1. The idea being is that Liu Kang now has his own timeline where it's this brand new timeline, and we're going to follow Kung Lao as like the Liu Kang stand-in, and that Liu Kang was going to be like Raiden and so on and so forth.
Gotcha.
Here's the problem, though. At about halfway through the game, they basically reintroduce Shang Tsung and basically just redo the big multiversal fight again from the last one. That's why, if for those of you that are following along, right? So like last time you had to set all of this table and we did it in 30 minutes and we speed run through the first section and all of that. And it generally tells one story that leads to like that has you facing off against Shang Tsung and Shao Kahn, and it kind of capstones into Shinnok and the Elder God series, and you know the Shang Tsung in Quan Chi, and then Onaga into Armageddon, where basically you're getting the escalation of evil, and you're getting this through line of they can't seem to get off a go. They keep getting each other, like the heroes keep getting in their own way, and they at least tie that back into Kronika was doing that intentionally the entire time. I don't know as though that was always the case, but they kind of redeemed some of those story points along the way. And then, you know, you get to this big cataclysmic event where I wish like the whole royal subplot and Blaze and all of that was more like, I wish I could say like, I'm only giving you Reader's Digest version so that way you go out and play the game. No, y'all, I just described the game for you. You know what I mean? Like, we're not writing Shakespeare here. And so like you've got that, and then the reboots that lead into this. And like, if you're following along now, I've got exactly like 3 minutes to talk about MK1 because it sucks, because it's a terrible game. And it's basically like just again Shang Tsung versus Liu Kang, and you had an opportunity to tell a really compelling story along the way that introduced something new, but this is where they went back into jumping the shark, and where a lot of people are just like, where do you even go from here? At this point, it almost feels like you either have to let the franchise die or just go off like completely separate and just create whole new characters. It's kind of like, for horror fans out there, they're basically sitting at the point where Halloween is at, where nobody is saying we want another Jamie Lee Curtis movie in the franchise, but really, what the hell do you do with these characters now at this point?
And I'm looking at the, because this is just what I've been doing for the past few games now. I'm looking at the DLCs for this. It continues to be silly. Omni-Man, Peacemaker. Come on, Joe. Ghostface is right there. Ghostface doesn't redeem this game for you at all. I will say, Conan the Barbarian is apparently one of the DLCs that you can get. That one is at least kind of makes sense. I could like get behind that one. Also, Sector is one of the DLC characters, and I only bring that up because initially I thought it said Skeletor, and I was like, hell yeah, that's a character I want to play as in Mortal Kombat. I want to play as Skeletor. That'd be great. So it's just bad. Is this... We've gone through 12 games, mentioned a couple of the spinoffs along the way. Is this like the first full miss? 9, 10, 11 seem to have like its moments that could maybe be chalked up to like preference almost, but is MK1 like truly the first big miss of the franchise?
Yeah, for sure. They're probably the most beloved section universally is the PS2 era, the 3D era of storytelling. There are a lot of fans of 9. 9 is a phenomenal game. The 10 and 11 are fine, but MK1 is just off a flat out miss.
Man. And if you had to pick a favorite, if you had to pick one of these, where are you going?
I'm going to go with 9.
Okay.
I think Armageddon is cool, but by and large, it's not like anything, right? Like it's like Scream 3. It's like these third entries into a trilogy.
Okay.
Where standalone, they're not as strong, but they sure. fit well within the franchise. With
gotcha.
9, it was an entirely new thing, and it was still hearkening back to that other timeline.
Gotcha. Okay, that makes sense. It does sound like also with Armageddon in particular, that one has like more of a cinematic feel to it. Big, bombastic. Everybody's here. We're all beating each other up. We'll see how this ends kind of thing. Big, bright, white light at the end to leave everybody hanging. So I could see how, as a story, from a story arc, again, standpoint, like, yeah, that one would probably be maybe not as a standalone, not as strong, but it could be a good finale still within that era. Before we get out of here, two last things before we get out of here, since we've gotten through our main continuity, any final real quick things you want to leave on the table here? Last time we talked in the previous episode, asked you about your favorite character, asked you about your thoughts on the upcoming movie, so you don't have to regurgitate that here, but any last thoughts on the MK video game franchise? We've only been talking for an hour and a half, so you know.
yeah. If you think that it's just palette swap ninjas and a tournament fight, then take in the lore, because the lore of this entire franchise is absolutely its strongest suit.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And especially if your entire frame of reference for the series is the 90s, it's time to expand out, because as we have clearly established in this episode in particular, it's really once you get out of the 90s with MK4 withstanding being in 97, but it's really once you get out of the 90s that you do get this large, bombastic lore, multiple timelines and time travel and escalation that, yeah, you definitely need to sit with this lore in order to really appreciate what it is. It's a great game. At the end of the day, it's still a fun game, even if you do just want to do arcade beat 'em up stuff. But like, there is so much more meat beyond that.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So just curious, before we get out of here, last thing I want to ask you, what have you been drinking this episode? What have you been working on?
Coffee. I've been drinking a blend from Hawaii. That's actually from the island that I put into a. I've got a French press thermos that I use that because
okay.
I am in fact that pretentious of a coffee drinker.
If it was a little bit closer, I could just reach over here and show you mine, because I am that pretentious of a coffee drinker as well. I was trying to find a beer that would kind of like go with what we're talking about today. There is a brewery out on the West Coast. Yeah, out on the West Coast, I think like Seattle area, that has an officially licensed Mortal Kombat beer series. They're bombers and they're not in my market, so hey, I love you all, but like that was going to be pretty expensive for me to get one here to show you all. But they have a Sub-Zero one, so it was really tempting. Nonetheless, I found this is from Maplewood. I don't know if you get Maplewood out in your area. They're pretty popular out here. Yeah. It might be a more of a regional thing. It's called Brunch Punch, so it's got a little bit of like a got a boxing glove there. It's a fighting game. That was about the best I could come up with. Brambleberry fruited sour ale. Joe and I have very different tastes in beers. Joe, what is your take on sour beers? Go ahead.
I don't mind a sour beer, but I'm more of a earthy IPA sort of guy.
Okay. Gotcha. I... am not. I am not an IPA guy. I don't mind a hazy every once in a while. Just a straight up IPA doesn't taste like anything to me. But like a hazy, usually once it's got like some grapefruit in there, then I don't mind. Sour beer is like one of my go-to styles, especially it's a little early in the year for me, but I really like it like springtime. Once you get like almost like Easter, April time, for some reason, I want it to be like sour candy, not just sometimes you get them and they're like tart. No, I want my gums to hurt a little bit after the first sip.
That's funny. Yeah.
Joe does not like stouts, and that's like my favorite thing. This is like one of the biggest divides that we have.
Yeah, no, I don't want to drink a loaf of bread. It's fine.
But Irish loaves of bread in beer form are so good.
Yeah.
All right, Joe, since the last time you were here, you launched a new comic book related podcast, or video series. Why am I forgetting?
Both. Podcast.
So tell the listeners a little bit about your newest project before we get out of here.
Understanding Comics is a space for new and old fans alike. The idea here is that we will be exploring different concepts, characters, and arcs from within comics. I'm a longtime fan, and I'm the type that I tend to read retro. I tend to read collections rather than going month to month with what's brand new on the shelf. And so I think this is a space where, you know, we'll be going through, you know, different histories, different characters, different concepts, things like that. And for those of you that are attuned to the multiverse of shows like Systematic Geekology, Friday Night Frights, as well as the rest of the ridiculous amount of shows between Anazao and KFM, then you will know one Christian Ashley, who is my co-host for Friday Night Frights. He just stopped by for a couple of episodes talking about 90s superhero cartoons, as well as a whole bunch of other stuff as well. So he may be a recurring voice on that show going forward.
Ooh, I'll have to check those out. I love 90s superhero cartoons. Batman TAS and Spider-Man were like two, and Batman Beyond. End of the 90s, more early 2000s, but those were like my three big ones there.
Yeah.
The superhero side of things. Unless we count Powerpuff Girls. Them too. You can find a link for Joe's Understanding Comics series in the description of this episode, along with all the other links. If you've hung with us for this long, thank you. You deserve a pat on the back, maybe a beer, a bougie French press of coffee, or, you know, some type of thing that's going to make you be able to control time and all the rest of the universes. Who knows? But thank you for listening to this episode. Rate and review it wherever you get your podcast. Pass this episode along to a friend. Check out my YouTube channel, Studio 219. We get a place for faith and pop culture. Thanks for listening again. This has been Kung Fu Pizza Party, where we have delivered high flying action. Looks like about three times over from the usual time amount, which is amazing. That's the purpose of these episodes. And served up some wisdom one slice at